Good morning. If you would go ahead and make your way on in, back to your seats. And when you get there, if you would please remain standing for the reading of God's Word. Sermon text this morning will be Habakkuk chapter 3, verses 17 through 19. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no fruit. The flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord of my, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated.
Welcome, everyone. If you're new with us today, glad you're here. My name is Jason Myers. I am one of the pastors of Piney Ridge Church. And for those who don't know me well, I am a bit of an introvert. I would often rather just sit by myself and read a book or play a game or watch a movie with my family or just a few friends. Meeting new people is not easy for me, and large groups are not my favorite. But despite my introversion, one of my favorite things about Sunday mornings is getting to catch up with people that maybe I haven't seen in a week or two or three. And that's what family and friends do, right? We check on each other. How have you been faring? And we normally do this by asking a question in one of two ways. There are variations of this, but we normally ask something like, how are you? How are you doing, right? Or on the other side, we ask, it's meaning the same thing, but it's a bit different. And we say, how have things been going? How are things? What's been happening in your life? How has your week been? And those are two different questions. How are you doing? And how are things going? Those are different questions. Let me illustrate it like this. Let's say you come in next week and you talk to somebody and you say, hey, what's been going on this week? How are things? And they say, well, if you must know, I lost my job. I got in a car accident. My dog died. And my wife is so distraught by all of this that she went to her sister's house for the weekend and she's not returning the calls. And that'd be a bad week. That'd be like a country song week, right? Not good. But suppose you ask somebody else and you ask it differently and you say, you do the other version of the question. You say, how are you? Like, how are you doing? And they say, I am great. No, I'm better than that. I am fantastically awesome. I am filled with such a sweet and deep joy that I've never known before. You might be tempted at that point to ask the other question to that same person. Okay, well then if that's the case, if you're so full of joy, then what's been going on? Like your intent is to figure out what's been happening in your week, how your circumstances led to such joy. But you probably wouldn't reverse that to the first guy that is having a terrible week. You probably wouldn't say, oh, okay, so how are you? Because you would expect them to say, I lost my job, my car, my dog, and my wife and all in one week, and you have the goal to ask me how I'm doing? You would expect them to have a terrible week, that they had a terrible week, that they would be feeling terrible, that they would be miserable. But you would be surprised to hear the other guy, the guy who's full of joy, when you ask him what's been going on this week, and you would be surprised to hear him say, well, actually, what's been going on this week is I lost my job, I got in a car accident, my dog died, and my wife is so distraught, she went to her sister's for the weekend, and she's not returning my call. After you get over the fact that this has happened to two different people in the same week, which is crazy, you'd say, are you joking? Like, or were you being sarcastic when you said you're full of joy? Because I don't get it. Did I miss something? What's been happening to bring joy? Because these bad circumstances doesn't do it. So what is it? And the reason we'd be surprised to hear that that's how his week going and yet he's full of joy is because that's not a normal response. That's not natural. That's not what is expected. But I think it'd also be surprising to us because often we have a hard time grasping or believing or living in accordance with the truth that our circumstances should not be the determining factor for our joy. Our circumstances should not be the determining factor for our joy. The fact that we experience God should be. Or we could say it this way, trusting that you will be always experiencing God's saving goodness, that should determine your joy. And that's what our text is about this morning. And we're going to unpack that a little bit later. But in Habakkuk chapter 3, verses 17, in the first part of verse 18, we find ourselves starting with a surprising response. A surprising response to a sad situation. And he says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Despite all of this, even though all of this is a sad situation, yet I will rejoice. That's a surprising response. We would expect him to do what he does in the first part of Habakkuk, in the chapter 1, the first message. In the book of Habakkuk that we preached on, we talked about how lamenting is normal. It's natural. It's even appropriate. When something is sad, we should feel sad about it. When things are terrible, we should lament that. And yet we don't only have to do that. We can lament because of loss. That's a natural response, and it's appropriate, even for Christians. Because he's experiencing real loss here. Loss, not just of just, you know, I was going to do a fun thing today and I missed out. Not just pleasures and comforts and modern conveniences. It's the necessities of life. This is real pain, real sorrow. Imagine his child at this moment saying, Daddy, I am hungry. I have no food. I'm cold, but there's no wool left. There's no leather left. There's no meat left. There's no grain left. There's nothing left. This is something to lament. That's natural and expected. But in this last message on the book of Habakkuk, he gives us an emphasis that's a bit different. He gives us the surprising response of joy. It's a surprising response because the natural response is to lament, but the supernatural response is to rejoice. It's a supernatural response to rejoice in the midst of such pain and loss. But it's not nonsense. He's not rejoicing because of the loss. He's rejoicing because of gain. He, just as loss produces sorrow, so gain produces joy. He believes that he is gaining something. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, I want to give you another surprising response that I think is equally surprising, maybe even more surprising. Joy is a surprising response to a sad situation. But let me give you a surprising response to a pleasant situation. Look at verse 17 again, and let's just imagine that it didn't read, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines. What if we read this? What if it said, though the fig tree is blossoming like crazy, and the fruit is ripe on the vines, the produce of the olive is increasing, and the fields are yielding food in abundance. There are more flocks in the fold than ever before, and the herd is safely and securely in the stalls. Though that pleasant situation, though all that's true, the surprising response is, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. That's a surprising response. And you know why? Because it's not natural. The natural, expected, normal response to such a pleasant situation is to rejoice in the pleasant situation, not to rejoice in the Lord. That's what's surprising. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. Oh, you say, I get it. So the Christian response, what's surprising to the world, is that we would thank God for giving us the things that we rejoice in. No. We are thank God for being what we rejoice in. Yes, we thank God for giving us things to enjoy. Yes, we thank God for his gifts. We should even enjoy the gifts God gives us. But my question is, to what end? Are we to enjoy God's gifts just as an end in themselves? Listen, God is never a means to something greater because there is nothing greater than God. God is always the means to himself because he's the greatest. So the gifts he gives us are what? Meant to be means to him. Not means to themselves. Not an end in themselves. They don't just fill us up in the end. All of God's blessings are meant to draw us to him, not distract us from him. Let me tell you how that works. And you can do this. Parents, you can do this with your kids this afternoon. Just talk to them about what it is you enjoy. What gives you pleasure? What do you delight in? What do you like about your life? and get to the depth of it. Like, what is it about this game that you enjoy? What is it about this song that you like? What is it about this person or this activity that you enjoy? I tell you, every single time, it's not just a gift from God. It is something of God himself. That is, you are experiencing something of the divine in every pleasant blessing you experience. When you find some comfort, some sweetness, some security, some power, some kind of joy, it's a fleck of God. It's something of him. It's not just from him as a source. It's a part of him as a substance. Not that it's God or that it's divine. I'm saying that it reveals and expresses you are experiencing God through it. We are experiencing God himself through every blessing he gives us. That's why all of his blessings are meant to draw us to him, not to distract us from him. You say, but aren't we supposed to be glorifying God by enjoying his gifts? Indeed. But fill that out. What does that mean? To glorify God by enjoying his gifts can't stop there. You have to glorify God by enjoying his gifts in a way that makes you enjoy him more. So you see that what you're enjoying is not just the thing itself, it's just a conduit of experiencing something of God. So you're saying, I'm experiencing something of God's beauty, God's power, God's wonder in this, through this thing. It's a blessing of God himself. So I want in order to enjoy God through his gifts, you have to think this way. You have to ask God to open your eyes to see it. God, what I'm experiencing, I'm having a great time with this thing. I enjoy this person. I love doing this. Show me what it is about you that I'm seeing and feeling and experiencing in this thing, because it is. It's of you. But enjoying the gifts to the neglect of the giver does not glorify him. If you enjoy the gifts of the giver and it distracts you from him, it does not glorify him. This is why we need to rejoice in the Lord in good times, in pleasant circumstances. It is a horrible and sad sin and a joy-destroying thing to ignore and to neglect and distract ourselves from God by the very blessings that he has blessed us with. That's not what they were intended for. And listen, this is the byproduct of this. You actually get to enjoy the things that God gives you more and better when you enjoy him through them, because you're enjoying them to the fullest as they were intended by God. In the end, all of it, you get to enjoy God. You're experiencing him through it. But if our circumstances are the determining factor for our joy, then we may end up only rejoicing in the gifts and not the giver. And then we would only have joy, a weaker and short-lived joy, not in Jesus. It would be a joy that is only there when our situation is wonderfully pleasant. But when life is as it is, a roller coaster, and the winds blow, we would be having joy, no joy all the time. Have you ever felt that? Wake up in the morning and you're feeling great. By 10 a.m., this day's horrible. We must have joy in Christ to have joy constantly. If in the stillness of the sea your joy in Jesus not be, then he'll never be enough when the waters turn too rough. If when things are going great, you're not rejoicing in the Lord, then when things are going poor, you won't rejoice in him then either. In fact, you will have no joy at all. Jesus is either your joy all the time, in all things, in all circumstances, or else your joy is limited to pleasant things and times and circumstances. But that's not what is happening for Habakkuk here, is it? He's saying, all the pleasant blessings, all the necessities of life are being stripped away. I'm experiencing terrible and unimaginable loss, and yet I will rejoice because I'm rejoicing in the Lord. Having this kind of joy, though, where it's circumstantial, this is like a situational joy. It ebbs and flows and changes all the time, and this kind of joy is not what Jesus wants for his disciples. In John 15:11, Jesus said, these things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full.
He wants us to have his joy. In Jesus, he's the perfect Son of God. He has perfect joy. And he says, I want you to have my joy, and I want you to be full of it. And this kind of joy is a joy that can't be lost. It doesn't rise and fall with every changing wind. It is constant. So it's there's a surprising response of joy in a sad situation. And there's a surprising response of joy in the Lord in pleasant situations. But let me give you from verses 18 and 19 the solid ground of joy regardless of the situation. Regardless of the situation. That's what Habakkuk is pointing us to. In verse 18, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. I want to give you practical help here, okay? I don't want to just give you some theoretical, theological idea that you say, okay, I should rejoice in the Lord, but that just seems like a very good religious thing, but I don't know what that even means. So I was trying to think of ways to explain it, and it's hard. It really is. It's something that you can't fully grasp, but let me just give you two ways to understand this, two handles, what it means to rejoice in the Lord, regardless of the situation. Number one, to rejoice in the Lord means to rejoice in who he is. To rejoice in the Lord means to rejoice in who the Lord is. Now, this is hard for us to imagine, hard for us to understand, because it's not like this with other people and with other things. If things don't perform for us the way we want them to, then it doesn't necessarily produce joy in us. And you can tell us about somebody, and we may say, cool. But it doesn't matter how amazing they are. But with God, you see, it's different, because God is unlike anyone and anything else. He is so unique, so supremely, excellently, wonderfully, gloriously majestic, that just to truly know something of him is to produce joy in you. If you could have a true grasp of something of who God is, it produces happiness at that very moment. Imagine you were sitting in a room with Jesus himself, and he revealed something of his glory, even a sliver. The hair in the back of your neck stands up. Your heart is racing. And you're thinking, I've never experienced anything like this. My Maker is before me. The judge of all the earth, the creator of the universe, the Savior, who is Savior alone and sovereign over all things. I see this much of him, and I'm undone. I'm overwhelmed. And at that moment, you think you're going to be wondering what's for lunch? You think you're going to be worried about your bills or your kids' education or health issues? In one sense, nothing else would matter at that moment. There is a pure ecstasy of being in the presence of God himself, and he shows you this much of him. Rejoicing in the Lord means to rejoice in who he is, having a grasp, even a little bit, of his aspects, of his attributes, of his character. To know God. Let me give you just three very quick practical applications from this. Read the Bible by asking the question, what does it tell me of God? Ask God that. God, would you show me something of you? This is your self-revelation. So what are you trying to tell me about you when I read this? You can read other books. There's great books on the attributes of God. It just tells you something of who he is. And your mind can even ache of just trying to put it all together at how incomprehensibly wonderful he is. But by God's grace, he will show you something, something new, something more, and each time will produce more joy in you because you rejoice by knowing something of who he is. Number two application in this would be to do the same thing by looking at the world around you, not just his word, but his world. Look at creation. All of creation is screaming, God made me. You can see his handprint on everything. That includes every person. There is something unique and something uniquely expressive of God through everything that he's made. God, as I go to the beach, as I go to the lake, as I go to the woods or to the mountains or in at the park or in my backyard with my family, when I see something that you have made, will you show me something of you in that? And thirdly, don't just look at his word and his world, but look at his works and ask God to show you something of himself. God, when you're working in my life, when you're working around me, may I see you in it. Which leads us to the second way that we rejoice in the Lord. It means not only to rejoice in who he is, but to rejoice in who he is by what he does. To rejoice in who he is by what he does. Look at verses 18 and 19 again. Second part of 18 says, I will take joy in the God, not just the God out there somewhere, the God who exists that no one knows, but the God of my salvation. The God who does something. He's a savior. God the Lord is my strength. What does God do? He makes my feet like the deer's. That's what God does. He makes me tread on my high places. This is the kind of God we're talking about. The God who does these things. This is who he is. I know who he is by what he does. To rejoice in the Lord then does not mean to rejoice in a being that you cannot experience or do not experience, but rather to rejoice in him whom you have experienced and whom you are experiencing all the time. We can only rejoice in God as we experience him in our lives through his word, through his world, and in his works, through his works in our lives. You cannot rejoice in him whom you do not know. You can't know him unless you experience him. But how do you, this last one about work, the question is now, how does one experience God working? How does one experience God as he works in our lives? Now, the common thought in this is that we only experience God working in our lives through pleasant circumstances, through times of ease and comfort, through temporal and physical blessings of life. But that's not true. Now, it is true you experience God through those things, but it's not true that you only experience him through those things. It's not just a God thing when you get some extra money, or not just a God thing in your life when you have you meet an old friend and you have a great time together, or when you get a good parking space up front. That must be a God thing. It is, but it's not just a God thing. You see, you experience God in so many other ways. Because Habakkuk here is saying, I rejoice in the Lord because I'm experiencing something of him. That's not just surprising. That would be nonsense if the only way to experience God is through pleasant circumstances, because he says, all my circumstances are terrible. Remember, our circumstances should not be the determining factor for our joy. Experiencing God should be, or better said, believing that we will always be experiencing the promised goodness of God. That should be the determining factor for our joy. Believing that we will always be experiencing the promised goodness of God. That should be the determining factor for our joy. This is what gives Habakkuk joy in the midst of sorrow and loss and terrible circumstances. He believes something. He has faith beyond sight that he will still be experiencing the promised goodness of God. Yes, even in his loss. He believes beyond what he sees, beyond what he feels, that he will always be experiencing the promised goodness of God regardless of the situation. This is his solid ground of joy, regardless of the situation. Notice that I'm saying, though, that joy comes from experiencing the goodness of God. It's not just experiencing God, but experiencing the goodness of God. I have a golden retriever named Charlie. He's really sweet and affectionate, not so bright. But he loves attention, any kind. So such when you're petting him, he wags his tail. Or when you smack his nose, get away from the table, he wags his tail. The kids can jump on him and wrestle with him or give him treats, and he's happy. As I said, he's not so bright. He just says, I'm getting attention from my master. I don't care if it's good or bad. That's not how we should be. It's not just to say, oh, I see, God is loving me or God is giving me wrath. They're both producing joy. That's not true. Because if that were the case, hell would be no different from heaven. Because did you know that every person in hell for all eternity will be experiencing God? They'll be experiencing only in him in his wrath. But see, the difference is heaven, we will only be experiencing his goodness for all eternity. So I'm saying that joy comes from experiencing the goodness of God. And so I'm saying, I think that what Habakkuk is saying is that whether we experience the goodness of God through physical and circumstantial blessings, or whether we experience the goodness of God through some other spiritual blessing, it doesn't really matter. In one sense, it just doesn't matter, because all of it is the goodness of God. And because God is who he is, his goodness, no matter how it comes, is sweeter and more wonderful and more satisfying than anything else we could ever even possibly conceive of. It is experiencing God in all of his glorious and gracious goodness that brings the fullest and deepest and everlasting joy. But notice too that I'm saying that we will always be experiencing the goodness of God. Always. For the true child of God, that is, those who are trusting in and submitting to Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord, there can never be even one moment where you are not experiencing the goodness of God. Not one. I don't care what your circumstances tell you. I don't care what your flesh or this world or Satan lies to you about. The truth is, you can never even for one moment not be experiencing the goodness of God. Now this takes us back to the idea that even though Habakkuk is facing unimaginable loss, he rejoices because of what he's gaining. If this week you lose your job and your car and your dog and your spouse, it will be terrible. And yet if you are one of God's true children, in the midst of all of that loss, you will also be experiencing gain, because you will still be experiencing something of the goodness of God. You will be experiencing some great goodness from God in the midst of your pain. And again, I'm not saying that you shouldn't lament terrible loss. You can and you should. It's appropriate and right. It's honoring to God even in the way you do it, if you do it the right way with faith. It's healthy for you and helpful for others to lament loss. But Paul says we can be sorrowful and yet always rejoicing at the same time. Because there are some gains that are completely unaffected by loss. There are some gains that cannot be stripped away, that moth and rust cannot destroy, and where thieves cannot break in and steal. There are some gains that transcend pain and sorrow, so that we can, in the midst of lament, rejoice. Indeed, there are even some gains. There are some gains of the goodness of God that can only come to us, that we can only experience through the loss of good circumstances. There are some gains of the goodness of God that we can only experience when God strips other good things away. The unstoppable promised goodness of God comes in many shapes and sizes. It is not monochromatic. It is not one-dimensional. Like we think, okay, God's going to bless me. I'm going to experience something of God's goodness today. It has to become in the form of an easy situation, a comfortable time, a pleasant circumstance. That's how it must come, because if I don't experience it that way, then it clearly is not the goodness of God. God must be mad at me. There must not be a God. I must be not having enough faith. I must be full of sin or something, because God is not showing me his goodness today. Listen to me. A God who is limited to and who cannot exceed your imagination and your prayers and your expectations is not a God worth worshiping or rejoicing in. A God who can only bless you with what your little mind can conceive of, what my little mind can conceive of, is not a God worth rejoicing in. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond all that we ask or imagine, to him be the glory. To that kind of God be the glory. He's worth rejoicing in. But think about it. If God can only do the best he could do is what we could think up, then we should get the glory, because it's our ideas. But he says, no, I want to surprise you with a different kind of joy today. I want to give you a different experience of me, sometimes of which you cannot experience through the ordinary blessings of life. And it's ordinary because that's often, yes, pleasant circumstances are ordinarily the way that God shows us his goodness. That's true, I think, for a lot of us anyway. But sometimes God says, I want to show you my goodness in unordinary ways. And sometimes I want to do it through extraordinary ways, miraculous ways. Sometimes he says, I will feed you with the food in the field. Other times I will feed you by a friend bringing something over to you when you didn't know it. That's unordinary. And sometimes I will bring manna caught falling from heaven to feed you. And sometimes you will have no food at all, but I will still sustain your life. And yet other times he says, you will even die in it, but it'll only usher in the fullness of joy in my presence forever. He says, you cannot find one place where my goodness is not. You cannot have one experience, one circumstance, one situation where I will not be giving you, my child, the fullness of my goodness that is necessary for your salvation and your fullest joy. Just not possible. In verses 18 and 19, he says, I will take joy in the God of my salvation. You realize, you could say it this way, that what should be the determining factor for our joy is believing that we will always be experiencing the saving goodness of God. Because every goodness that he gives us, every experience of God is meant, as we read, and as Paul read for us in 1 Peter, you only have blessings and you only have pain and sorrow and grievous trials if necessary. Necessary for what? Necessary to bring you home, that you can have the full portion of God himself. If it's necessary for your fullest joy in him, he says, for your complete salvation, I'm the God of your salvation and I will do whatever it takes. I am so committed to your everlasting joy in the salvation I promised that I will give you that. He says, God the Lord is my strength. He saves me by strengthening my feeble knees, it says in verse 16. Where I'm weak and I don't think I can stand. He goes, I will cause you to stand. I will strengthen you. I will strengthen your faith. I will strengthen your hope and your peace and your joy. I will make you have feet like a deer. A deer's feet is agile and swift and stable even under very rocky terrain. When the road is rough, I will give you strength and give you feet like a deer that be able to stand. And Isaiah says that deer leap for joy. So yes, even in the midst of sorrow and pain and loss and suffering and chaos, you can still have joy. I will make you to stand on high places. High places represent security and safety and even sustenance, that he will take care of you, provide for you, and he will cause you to rejoice. This is what God does for us. Habakkuk is saying, I don't know how. I don't know where. But I know that all the time, that not only one day he will save me completely, but all the time, every moment, he is saving me because he's the God of my salvation. I was racking my brain this week. You can ask Nathan. I talked him to death. To try to just say, how can I get people to grasp this? I want them to understand it, to feel it, so that they walk out of here saying, yes, I rejoice in the Lord. What kind of illustration can I give? What kind of explanation can I give? And I realize there's nothing. There's nothing I can do. God must do it. So ask him to open your eyes to this truth, what Habakkuk saw. Read his word and say, God, show me what it is to rejoice in you, how worthy you are. Would you open my eyes to your word and to your world and to your work in my life, that I may see that I'm experiencing you and all of your goodness all the time, and cause me to rejoice. But that takes great faith, especially in times of great loss. The situation is sad and circumstances are terrible. We need a faith beyond sight that holds on to the promise that we will still be experiencing God's goodness, his saving, satisfying goodness through all the storms and all the droughts of life. Remember, the solid ground for joy, regardless of the situation. That which should be determining factor for our joy is believing that we will always be experiencing the promised and saving and satisfying goodness of God. And we must note one more thing. It's not merely that we are believing that we will experience the goodness of God, but the promised goodness of God. That is the solid ground of joy. He has promised. This is what Habakkuk is believing in, God's promise that he will always experience God in his great goodness, regardless of the situation. Look here in verse 18 again. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. You might see in yours that it's all caps, even with the small capital letters, O-R-D. Again in verse 19, God, it's the same word, it's Yahweh. It's the personal covenant name of God. It's the covenant-keeping, promise-making name of God. And so when we see, he says, I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes me tread on my high places. Habakkuk, how do you own high places? How do you say, can claim salvation as your own and strength as your own from God? It actually says in the Hebrew, I don't know why it's not translated here in the ESV. The first word in verse 19, God is Yahweh. The second, the Lord is Adonai. Means overcoming one, almighty conquering one. But it's God, my Lord, in the Hebrew. How can you claim that he is your Lord? Because he has promised to be mine. That's what it means to be in a covenant with God. He says, I am yours and you will experience me in all of my goodness all the time. That's what he's promised. So you can claim it as your strength and your salvation and your high places and, yes, your joy, because he is your God. He has promised it in Jesus Christ. And that's the focal point. The ultimate focal point of God's promise to be good to us is Jesus. The climax, the culmination of each and every and all of the Old Testament events and prophecies and promises all together, the climax and the culmination is in Jesus. The goodness of God promised all comes down to grace through Christ. How could God promise the everlasting experience of himself in all of his glorious goodness to a people, to me, and to you, who are so sinful and rebellious and doubting and so easily distracted by and seek joy in the lesser things and circumstances, making idols at every turn? How could God promise such joy and experience of himself to us? God, being holy and just, and yet being gracious and loving, condemned all of this sin in Jesus, who paid for it on the cross for everyone who trusts in him. And now the risen and exalted Jesus ever lives to intercede for us, asking the Father to give us perfectly skilled, perfectly suited, perfectly timed experiences of himself in all of his glorious goodness based on the promise secured by Jesus, by his life, his death, his resurrection, for all those who trust in him. And so this morning, if you're not trusting in Jesus, if you're not giving your whole self to Jesus and accepting all of who Jesus is for you, then the communion meal is not for you, because neither is the promise. Listen to me, hear me. God has not promised ever-present experience of his goodness to everyone. He has not. He has promised it only to those who trust in Jesus Christ. You don't have it unless you have him. And so you should have no joy unless you trust in Jesus. If that's you this morning, instead of coming up to partake of communion when others do, I would ask that you would stay in your seat and just pray. Or you can come up, I'll be in the front, and maybe Pastor Steve can take communion quickly and be in the back, and we would love to pray with you about that. Or you can put it on one of the cards on the back of the seat, and we will connect with you this week about it, because it would be our joy, our delight to do so. This communion meal is not yet for you. But if you are trusting in Jesus, and you know that you have the goodness of God promised to you, the saving and satisfying goodness of God, experiencing God himself through all kinds of different blessings, some circumstantial, some not. If you're trusting in Jesus, then in just a moment, if you've had your faith affirmed by other Christians in baptism, then you can exit to your left and come up to one of these tables, go to the back to one of those tables, and tear off a piece of bread that represents the broken body of Jesus, and dip it into the juice that represents the shed blood of Jesus, knowing that he gave his body, he gave his blood to secure the promise of you experiencing God's goodness forever. And you go back to your seat, and take it with faith and all that it represents and who Jesus is and what he's done, and you take it with joy in worship, because that's what this is about. Verse 19, the very last phrase of the book of Habakkuk, to the choir master, it says, with stringed instruments. This is meant to be sung. This is a prayer meant to be a prayer of praise, a psalm that is meant to lead us to a hopeful, joyful worship of the God who we constantly experience and who promised us in Jesus that we will always experience him in his goodness. So if that's you, you can come. And if you want to just take communion and go back to your seat and worship with joy, then you can do that. But if you also want to have prayer, again, I'll be up here in front of the stage and Pastor Steve will be in the back and we will pray with you about anything. Maybe you're struggling. Maybe you're struggling with this reality of loss and how to rejoice in the midst of sorrow and how to trust God for his goodness, to experience him. We will pray with you about that or for anything else. When you're ready, please come.